This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of plantyourself.com. Olivia Kelly had already been a fitness trainer, a surfer, a stock trader, a political consultant, a world traveler, and a writer for the Rough Guides when she turned her attention to health. Olivia is the CEO of WellStart Health, which is a startup wellness company whose foundation is a plant-centered diet. That's really big. There are so many wellness companies out there trying to help us bring down insurance costs and lower rates of disease and disability. There are a ton of companies with brilliant technologies. There are a ton of companies with brilliant like behavioral psychology underpinnings. But there are almost no companies that understand the science of how we actually get well. And Olivia is the CEO and co-founder of one such company. So she's armed with this why not me attitude, this background in fitness and health, and a really big dream. And so she co-founded WellStart Health to change the game in corporate wellness and healthcare. It's a big task, given that there's roughly $3 trillion spent every year on healthcare in the U.S., and I got to say, almost none of it is being spent productively. So Olivia and I talked about her journey, her background, and how she leveraged her skills and experiences to design and grow a health promotion program that actually works for human beings. So without further ado, Olivia Kelly, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thanks. It's great being here.
There's a lot to talk about. Let's start with the topic at hand, and then we'll get into kind of your really interesting and fun backstory. But tell us about WellStart Health and what it is and what you're hoping to achieve.
So WellStart, it began a year ago when I had been thinking about ways to move healthcare upstream and to, give a more prevention focus, a greater prevention focus to healthcare, and thinking about different ways to do that, which I'd been thinking about since I was in my master's in public health program at UCLA. And initially it was a more of a brick and mortar kind of idea where there would be sort of retail clinic that had a preventive focus. But then I realized, well, people probably aren't going to want to pay for this, individuals. And then also it's very capital intensive to do that, to have these like in, say, drugstores everywhere. And also we have now the shut-in economy where everybody wants everything brought to their door, which has its good and bad points. But the good part is, of course, it enables many, many touch points with people remotely. So I met my co-founder. She's a preventive medicine physician. She was based in San Diego County and was seeing patients from all over who wanted to either kick their chronic disease medications or not go on them in the first place, and really reached out to her for help. So we got together. We designed a curriculum. And also she had previously taught the Complete Health Improvement Program.
Hans Diehl's.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So, which, you know, a lot of the principles of that are very synergistic with what we're doing as well. So we wrote the curriculum, we designed it, we recruited 21 participants, and we ran an 8-week program. The full WellStart program is 12 weeks, but this first pilot was only 8 weeks just because we were up against some time constraints like the holidays and things like that. And we did everything piecemeal. So it was the physician visits that we offer, which are, so we offer telemedicine visits throughout the program. They were all done through FaceTime. We have daily texting, motivational texting from the health coach, which I was doing with everybody every day from my job at UCLA. Hopefully no one at UCLA listens to this. Then we had a group discussion that we used a Google group for. So there's an online group discussion component, social support component. We pushed our daily articles through MailChimp to everybody, which is basically like little snippets that comprise the curriculum for the program. And then people just self-reported their progress, whereas in the future, when we have a fully developed app, people will be able to track their progress and have a dashboard showing how they're doing, and that they'll be able to set their daily goals and track their daily goals, things like that. So it's a program for people who have all of the major lifestyle-related chronic illnesses, which are caused by lifestyle, and they can be fixed by lifestyle. And so that's the real principle we're operating under, is that we can teach people how to do this, how to eat a more plant-centered, minimally processed diet, and to put in place, if they don't already have one, or improve their social support structure, to take time each day for physical activity, to take time each day for self-care. And so those are the main components of the program. And we have probably more than 20 touch points with each patient throughout each week through the 12-week program. And then after the 12 weeks, though we are only now ramping up for our second pilot, in the future we will have weekly text check-ins with the health coach for the remainder of the year after the 12 weeks is up. So our first pilot was super successful. We were really, really pleased with the results. We took biometrics before and after the program, and everyone improved dramatically. Well, I shouldn't say everyone. 80% stayed in the program, and those 80% improved dramatically. Cholesterol dropping into the normal range, blood pressure going into the normal range, prediabetes, so blood sugars dropping. And so this all happened in only 8 weeks' time. And also a quarter of participants reduced or eliminated their medications. So we were very pleased with that, and we were very pleased with the ecosystem that we built to help empower the patients, because they were really positive about the program and feeling really great about their own self-efficacy. So that's the WellStart program, and the idea is that we want to take it, we want to expand it in California and then nationally. We want to offer to employers, health systems, and health insurance companies.
All right. So that's a great overview. So I took a bunch of notes on things that I want to ask you about, but like the first question is like, who are you to do this? like, you know, it's such a big thing. And like every company has their wellness program, and, you know, huge companies, like everyone's like sharks in the water smelling blood, like around our health insurance premiums and diseases. Like, what made you think that, you know, I went online and looked up as much as I could find about you. And there's like this really cute video of you and your co-founder sitting on these giant bean bags talking about this stuff. And like you're wearing your winter boots, and it just seems so like informal and college dorm. And like, you know, I'd love to get a sense of, right. And I know a little bit about your, you know, your backstory and how like freaking impressive it is. But let's go there. Like, you know, what makes you think like, you know, you could change this behemoth of a mess of healthcare?
Well, I'll give you the short answer. It's the winter boots. really, it's, and also just to give you a little context, that video was shot as part of our application for the TechStars program. The TechStars, they have a healthcare accelerator here in Los Angeles. So hence, partly that was the informality. If we were doing this for, you know, Aetna, we would have probably done this a little differently.
Right. But it seemed very genuine. It didn't seem like you guys were stretching much. Like that seemed like really who you are, right?
Yeah. I think we were trying to be who we are. And who are we to do it? Maybe we seem a little less formal than your typical, I don't know, I was going to say your typical entrepreneur, although that's not really, there's a lot of entrepreneurs who are, you know, younger and weirder than we are. but, you know, as I said, my co-founder has a preventive medicine background. She did her residency at Loma Linda in preventive medicine, which you probably know that Loma Linda is one of the blue zones where they have some of the most centenarians, of anywhere in the world. And it's because they have a high population of Seventh-day Adventists, two-thirds of whom are either vegetarian or fully plant-based. And they also have, of course, a lot of social support, faith. There's other components to it. But But so Loma Linda is really a hub for preventive medicine, and that's where she did her residency. She was doing a residency prior in pediatrics and realized she didn't want to do sick care. She really wanted to tackle the problems further upstream. And I was working at UCLA at the Center for Healthier Children, Families, and Communities, which was also trying to tackle upstream determinants of health and look at whole life course health development from in utero on. So I was thinking about ways to tackle things differently, because just health saved me growing up. I had a difficult childhood in many ways, and it just kind of brought me, elevated me out of it, focusing on my health and focusing on studying health. And I started my own fitness company in college and was working with kids and adults, helping them get healthier and more fit. And it's just, it really rescued me. And it was something that it's something I've always been so passionate about, because it made my life so much better. It's made me be able to rise above so many challenges. And I just have this burning desire to share that with other people.
It sounds like I don't want to ask too personal questions, but if there's anything you want to share about like your childhood and like what role health played in it and how you came to it, like that's very interesting to me.
Yeah. I mean, really it was just a tumultuous childhood with moving a lot and ugly divorce and things like that. And also I was an only child, and so didn't really have anybody to kind of bounce any of that off of. I later had a lot of younger half siblings, but that was when I was already like a teenager. I just really had a lot of instability in my life. And I think sports and health and paying attention to nutrition and learning about it and fitness, that was like my escape. That saved me.
Wow. You realize how like weird that is, right? To deal with life stresses by getting healthy, as opposed to like eating junk food and vegging out and taking drugs and stuff. Like,
yeah, I mean, I guess it's definitely not something maybe you hear about every day, but I mean, I think a lot of athletes do feel like they pour themselves into their discipline to whatever sport they're doing, as some form of escape. And so that was maybe the analog for me. I did run track and cross country and did that. So I did do sports, but I was also just really into fitness I got a personal training certification when I was 18. I think just seeing the unhealthy things that were going on in my life and the way my parents lived their lives, and knowing that I wanted to do it a little differently. And they definitely imbued some of the healthy habits in me, but I think I just realized that if I could, it was a way of like protecting myself, to take care of myself in a way that no one else is doing.
So I'm curious about, like, were you plant-based or focused on that then? Because, you know, a lot of athletes who think they eat healthy, like I look at their diets and just see, 13 chicken breasts for lunch and protein shakes, and I shake my head. But what was your version of a healthy diet, and where did you learn about it?
Yeah, and that's funny, because at the time, like, I was in high school in the 90s when it was like everyone was eating snack balls and they thought that was healthy, you know. So for sure, like, I wasn't plant-based, but I wasn't fully plant-based, and I'm still not 100% plant-based. I'm like 85 to 90% plant-based, but I am vegetarian. At the age of 11, I asked my dad if I could be a vegetarian, and he was like, "You're gonna starve. You'll be the only vegetarian who eats no vegetables." I didn't eat my vegetables at the time. I admit it was a struggle for me at that age. And then the next year, I moved to my mom's house, and she was making steak for dinner one night, and I just said to her, "You know what? Don't make steak tonight or ever again." And that was it. And so at age 12, I kicked meat and I kicked I think I kicked meat and fish and then later chicken. I don't remember exactly what the order was, but I decided I didn't want to eat anything with a face again after that.
And it sounds like
I'm
it was
not exactly sure.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a combination of ethics and health.
Yeah, it's just this overwhelming feeling that I had that was the right thing to do and that I ought to be doing that. And it stuck with me from then on. So I think that was a big component of that. Yeah, it was probably health as well. You're probably right.
Okay, cool. So you ran a personal training business in college. Was that with fellow students?
No, I started it, and I was teaching fitness classes, and then I started the personal training, and I met this woman who was training kids and adults on TV and movie sets, because I was in L.A., I'm back in L.A. now, and so she had more business than she could handle, and I had just gotten my certification and was just trying to get the business going, so she handed a big chunk of her business over to me for the private clients that she didn't have time for. And so I did that, and then I just grew and expanded my business, and then I also started working with high school kids who needed help because they weren't really moving enough. And so I started training, coaching them as well.
So you work with like movie and TV stars?
I didn't. Yeah, that would be a good story. She kept the movie and TV stars and then gave me the people that weren't the movie and TV stars that she didn't have time for.
Well, like the writers and producers and video.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. That's so exactly. So 1 degree of separation.
Yeah, 1 degree. Still, I guess, semi-glamorous to some people.
Yeah. So you graduated, and then what?
I graduated college, and then I got a custom shaped surfboard for myself, and I packed a little bag and I traveled around. I got it around the Pacific plane ticket, and I just traveled around and surfed and saw some different cultures and spent on and off. I traveled for about a year and a half actually. I wasn't really ready to do anything real yet.
Wow, you traveled around the Pacific Rim with a surfboard.
I did, yeah, I did. And then I just kept trying to figure out ways to keep it going. So I came home in the summer and I worked. I did some training with some of the clients. I still was kind of able to keep or rustle up again. And then I went back and then I also was doing a little bit of stock trading at the time. And it was a really kind of crazy time where, stocks were like splitting and then going up again. And I bought a few shares of Amazon that ended up being a few thousand dollars like a couple of months later. So I was just kind of lucky and I was able to keep it going for a little while, the travel. Yeah. So I did that. And then.
So you have a history of succeeding in areas where you really shouldn't even have been like dabbling, right?
I guess so. I mean, I don't know. I think the writing, the travel writing, which I did afterwards, kind of made more sense because I was always a writer and wanted to be a writer and was always a traveler. So that was a good fit. But yeah, I guess I kind of lucked out with the stock market thing. Yeah.
But it's not just that. It's like what I hear lacking in your mental machinery is like the question that I would ask myself like 12 times an hour, like, who am I to be doing this? Right.
And we still, I don't know if we've fully gotten to that yet. That's what you asked me. But really my answer to that was just that the passion and my interest in health and my background helping people, and then my master's in public health, which was in policy and management. So
I mean more generally, like you don't seem to have that question, like that's my default question a lot of the time, or it has been. Like it's a thing to overcome. It seems like either you jettisoned it really young, or you were born without it. It's not a great question, from personal experience. It's not the most useful thing to be to be constantly asking yourself. So, you know, I'm just seeing the pattern of like, hey, why not? You know, why not me? It's awesome.
I guess I'm, I like to fake it till I make it. And that's sort of my philosophy with WellStart, because it is a big undertaking and it's something that, you know, we're hoping to scale pretty big. And definitely that's not something that I've done before. And, but I guess, I don't know anyone better to do it than me.
Right on. If someone else were going to do it, they'd have done it, right?
Yeah. Well, it's hard to do. Like, people ask me if I'm talking to someone about WellStart, you know, and they're like, oh, well, do you want me to sign an NDA or whatever? And I'm almost always say no, because to me, this is such a difficult undertaking. I mean, any startup is, but trying to help people with chronic disease arrest and reverse their conditions, and trying to find a way to do it that's going to be engaging and work and prove ROI. Like, if that's so hard to do. So if someone else really wants to roll up their sleeves and try to do that, more power to them, because the market is huge.
Right.
Sadly, it's enormous. It's almost endless.
Yeah. That's I've taken permaculture and farming courses, and one of my teachers said something that reminds me of your comment about no NDAs. He said, I copyright my mistakes and I open source my successes.
I like that. That's good. Yeah.
Okay. So, a large part of the program that you've described is basically about various forms of communication. So what's your interest and background in communication itself, as opposed to specifically around health?
Well, writing would be number one, the core of that, because I was writing from a very young age, and I did some journalism and, of course, some travel writing, and then I dabbled myself in a bit of TV writing as well. So that's the core of my communications kind of, I guess, skills form. But beyond that, I did work in communications. I worked for an LA City Council member as her communications director. So I was her speech writer, and I wrote all her press releases, and I prepped her for press conferences and all that, and I did her for a whole online presence and social media and all of that. So that helped me communications-wise, more on a mass communication scale rather than one-on-one communication. But and then I was a psych major undergrad, so a little bit of communications there too.
Okay. And you also worked in
motivation is a huge part of it. It's really like a form of cheerleading. And I did want to be a cheerleader, and I didn't make the squad. So maybe this is like my second chance at cheerleading, because I get to motivate people every day.
in the winter boots, like a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Which, of course, in Los Angeles, like if it drops below like 74 degrees, you have to put your winter boots on and your beanie. So, yeah. Okay.
So you also dabbled in politics, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say a little more than dabbled. I worked on the Obama campaign in 2008. I actually worked for the California Democratic Party. They were their campaign activities around the Obama campaign, and then around all of these ballot initiatives in California. So I ran a campaign field office, and I was field organizer. And then from there, I got a job working for Councilwoman Janice Holmes, who's now in U.S. Congress. Yeah, mm-hmm. And so, I did that for a couple of years.
What did you learn through political organizing?
What did I learn? Yeah, you know, there's a lot of similarities actually between political organizing and health organizing, if you can call it that. There is definitely like a leadership and cheerleading kind of aspect to it, and really trying to, I think, get to the core of the why, of why people want to do something, and try to drive them that way. Because people, it's hard, you know, there's a lot of inertia, as you know, and we all have it. But trying to really find that core why that's driving people to do something or avoid doing something, and kind of speak to that and use that as the motivator. So I would say that was a big thing.
Uh-huh. And, you know, to me that sounds like marketing, but it seems like there's more of a similarity around health and politics than, you know, trying to sell somebody, a car or a course or something, in that these are both sort of complex intangibles, and people bring their own opinions that may be, you know, misguided or incorrect. And you kind of have to be very sort of gentle and strategic at the same time with people, don't you?
You do. It's very personal. They're both very personal things. Politics and people's health, they're very personal to them. So, yeah, it's definitely different, I'd say, in that way from, any other type of marketing. For sure. And there's a lot of, also preconceived notions and expectations and all of that.
Hmm. All right, so you and Lindsay, the preventive doc, started this, and you said let's recruit some participants. So where did you find them? The 21 for the initial pilot.
Some folks were her patients that were already existing patients that decided they wanted to do the program. We offered it at no cost to the pilot participants, which we're actually, little plug, we're offering it at no cost to the next pilot participants. While we're recruiting them now, we're trying to get 100 people for our second pilot.
And is that locally, or can people do it from anywhere?
You know, they should be in California because of interstate telemedicine laws, the restrictions. Fortunately, they should be in California, but because it would be probably a little easier if we could expand across the border. But
okay, so at the end of this call and in the show notes, I'll include information for people in California who want to jump in.
Oh, awesome. Great. Thank you. So some of them were her patients, some were friends of patients, and then we had some of our own friends and our own family, and then a couple people that we recruited through a couple of online message boards that we were on for different things. So,
mm-hmm.
It was actually astonishingly quick and easy to get the participants, which has not proved true this time around.
Huh.
It's just so much more, many more people we want to get.
Right. So it doesn't sound like this group was your typical, like, highly motivated, desperate people, right? There's a, you know, when we look at like Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn studies, one of the design-based criticisms is, well, these people were highly motivated. They're not representative of the general public. It sounds like you just sort of, friends and family, convenience people who weren't necessarily, like, high stakes into this. Is that accurate?
That is somewhat, yeah. I mean, I would say we kind of bent the criteria towards being a little bit more inclusive just because we really wanted to get the people. So if their BMI was, say, only 25, we would take them, or if now we want to be over 25, just as one example. So yeah, there were, we bent the criteria a little bit that way, but, and it's true. Our population overall was maybe slightly healthier than would be the norm, but everyone still had high risk factors.
Hmm. Gotcha.
But yeah, you're right. They weren't all heart attack survivors.
Right. I mean, which to my mind means that, you know, if it works on them, it'll sort, you know, if it works on people who are at death's door, who are highly motivated, we don't know if it'll work, if it'll be motivating, or whether these people came, you know, sort of healthy volunteer effect, all pre-motivated.
Right.
So what did you,
right,
when you sat down and you said, okay, we've got these 21 people, we're going to run a 8-week because of the holidays, right? Want to get this out of the way before, like just putting it together on a whiteboard somewhere, what did you think needed to be in the program in order for people to succeed?
Well, the physician visits were an important part of it, we felt, because though at some point down the line we may decide to use physician extenders rather than physicians, the street cred that the physicians offer up is important to a lot of patients. A lot of patients want that credibility of having physician guidance. And most physicians don't really know anything about nutrition therapy, as you know, and they don't prescribe it. So having a physician who does have a background in it and does know, not only how to prescribe nutrition therapy, but what to be careful of in terms of adjusting medications along the way was important to us. So that was important. And then having numerous touch points. So texting daily by a real person and not an algorithm to check in with people, I think was a really big part. There were a couple people who said, oh, you know what? I don't love this text, because we surveyed everybody a couple times during the program. I don't love this texting every day. I got it. I could do it. I get it. But then there were many, many people who said, I really love getting texted every day. That pushed me.
So what sort of things would you write to people via text?
Well, we checked in and we have daily goals. So that includes having at least 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables, having at least 1 cup of legumes, drinking at least 64 ounces of water, moving around for 30 minutes, not necessarily in one chunk, and doing at least 5 minutes of self-care, preferably 30 minutes. So those are the that comprises the daily checklist. So we would check in with people about that and see how, good morning, don't forget to send it. We'd ask them for their daily goal. If they had a goal beyond that, beyond just the checklist, we worked them up toward the checklist. And then beyond that, it was like, some people were then starting to count steps and saying they wanted to walk, 8,000 steps or 10,000 steps, or they wanted to, they knew what their struggles were and their weaknesses were within the program, and so they would maybe tailor their goals accordingly. Uh-huh. And then, so we would check in with them, what's your daily goal and how's it going? And then we had a walking challenge, a couple walking challenges where we had people in smaller teams and they were competing for who got the most steps. And so we would check in with them about that as well.
Let's talk about the competition. What made you decide to include that?
Well, we just know from like a behavioral economic standpoint that people like having friendly competition and it does motivate them. So we thought we'd give it a try, and people did really like it. Overall, people were excited. They talked about it on the group discussion board, because what we did, we had the group discussion was broken up into 3 groups of 7, and those were also the teams for the walking challenge. So, within the group discussion, you see people going, come on, let's do it. We're in the lead, get out there tomorrow. And so that kind of helped push people along. So it was the sense of community and the sense of competition that we wanted to have going on.
And I don't know if you have any data on this, but, one of the things that interests me is short-term versus long-term efficacy around, if you give somebody a good reason to do a project, a short-term thing, like when the walking challenge is over or the competition is over, did you find that people's habits had become ingrained, or did their motivation wane when they weren't doing it for kudos or a prize?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, kudos is really it, because there was no prize.
Uh-huh.
But I found the people that really embraced the challenge and were getting really into it seemed to continue to walk a lot afterwards. I can't say exactly, because we had those challenges in the second half of the program, so I don't really know longer term, although we're maintaining follow-up with several participants who are definitely moving more and still continuing to maintain a plant-centered diet. So I can't say exactly with the walking challenge, and it's true. It's tricky with I certainly believe if you give people a discount on something to motivate them, you're not going to get a lot of bang for your buck out of that. It's going to wane really quickly. So I think more intrinsic motivators are definitely the way to go generally.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And what about the online discussion? I know from, you know, from doing various online courses that it's really hard to get people to log on to another thing. You know, what was your experience with that?
Especially when it's a Google group, because Google groups are really hard to use. We didn't do a Facebook group. We could have done that, but and in the future, once our app is fully developed, that's what we're, one of the things we're excited about is everything will be in one place. The group discussion's just going to be just really like one or two clicks into the app, and you'll be in the group discussion. But you're right. Some people really don't like group discussion. They resist it. And I have to say, like, I'm probably one of those people that would not be super excited about online group discussion to begin with. But even those who were resistant at first did say that they thought it was a positive experience. And we asked everybody to log on to the group discussion at least twice a week. And we posed two questions to them each week so that they could discuss.
Uh-huh. Gotcha. And so what were some of the benefits that came out of the group discussion?
I mean, I think the community aspect of it, because obviously when you have a program that's totally remote and digital, you don't have that in-person support. And it doesn't take the place of in-person support. And we try to get people to build some of that in-person support scaffolding with their friends and their family and their community. We try to give them some resources and ideas about how to do that. But as far as what we can do is we can offer them that support online so they can bounce ideas, questions, successes, challenges off of one another. Whether it's something as simple as like, here's a great recipe I found to, this is so hard not to have a late night snack and how do you do it and how do you not, you know, go for the chocolate and then someone says, try eating a date and a couple walnuts and that is like such a good little treat. Uh-huh. I mean, little things like that, but that help people. Or, I'm really having a hard time finding 30 minutes of my day to move around. Like, what do you guys do? Oh, someone says, I like to do wall sits in my office. Things that some people may have already thought of, but others might not have. And also just the feeling that they're in it together and that they're not doing this alone.
Yeah. One of the things I've discovered is when I give advice to other people, it's usually advice that I should have given to myself already.
Uh-huh.
Right? It's like, this one time I had two dates and a walnut and it seemed to help. So I'll say it as if it's like what I do and then it becomes what I do.
That's true. It is self-reinforcing. Yeah, you're right. And that is good. I mean, maybe that the people who are benefiting most in the group discussion are not, maybe they're not benefiting most from each other. Maybe they're benefiting most from themselves. But be that as it may, they're still benefiting. And I think you're right. I think helping others or teaching others something or giving advice often is something that's reflective.
So what were the biggest challenges that you found in the pilots that you've done? What did people need the most help with or found the most difficult to implement or to wrap their heads around?
I think eating plant-based and eating minimally processed foods is definitely, I would say, the biggest overall challenge. And it's also the cornerstone and the backbone and the core of the program. I mean, if you don't do that, everything else is important. But if you don't do that, you're not going to see the benefit in a stark way. I think it's very, very hard for a lot of people. One participant in the program, he was really trying to change his diet, and his habits were not so great. But his wife was not helping at all. She really just, was kind of digging in her heels and sticking to her old habits, and that was very hard for him. So, even if you have great intentions of wanting to, change the way you're eating, I think you've got to have some support structure around you, which is one of the reasons why we would like to try to expand this program to allow people to invite a friend or a family member in with them, and they wouldn't, that friend or family member wouldn't necessarily have all of the components of the program, but they would at least get all of the information, all of the resources, so that they could, you know, participate alongside them.
Uh-huh.
I think that's really important. So I think that's a challenge. We had a couple, actually a couple couples in the program, and they did well because they were able to motivate and cheer each other on. And so, I just think the habits are so ingrained, and people maybe, you know, have this illusion of grandeur, like, oh, I'm going to do this, and it's going to be so great, and it's going to change my life in 1 second. And true, energy, I mean, people start to feel more energy, they start to feel really a lot better, you know, in a matter of a couple weeks, but maintaining that and, you know, getting people in the headspace where they are preparing ahead of time and strategizing, or how am I going to, you know, plan ahead for success so that I can eat this way throughout the week, or so that I can go to a restaurant or a work party and not trip up. And the thing is, everyone's going to trip up, but if you can make the default the better choice, well, that's what we're trying to teach them. So, of course, that's the overarching challenge, but I feel like we succeeded in many respects.
Did you find that you had trouble convincing people of the science? Because, you know, there's plenty of doctors and diet books and websites and, you know, sources of information that offer different interpretations. And there's an article a day from the major media, you know, kind of trying to dispute what you and I know is true about nutrition. Did you find that was a challenge to kind of get people, you know, bring people back from the edge after they would read a Time magazine article or something on their Facebook feed?
I didn't feel like we needed to bring people back from the edge as much as just convince them in the first place. I mean, for example, there was a doctor in the program who was, I mean, I think he was definitely willing to go along, and he was pretty well convinced, but also being like a traditional mainstream physician, it was very, I think it was a little hard for him to grasp at first and to swallow that, like, well, if this is really true, then why isn't everybody doing it? Which is, of course, yeah, the big million-trillion-dollar question. It's certainly, I think it is really hard. And the thing that I find challenging, too, is, like, in just trying to recruit other physicians into the fold, is sometimes you find somebody who, you know, understands the power of plant-based nutrition, and they teach that to their patients, but then they're also teaching a lot of other stuff, or they're also providing a lot of other services that are maybe not seen as mainstream. So it's like, you know, people equate plant-based nutrition with maybe things like Ayurveda and acupuncture, which all maybe have their benefits, but the point is they just see it as like this, it's only integrative medicine, it's only Eastern medicine, it's not, it's like they have to compartmentalize it as a fringe thing.
Right. Either they're anti-science, right, or anti-Western medicine, in which case they get to do plant-based eating and Ayurveda and homeopathy and crystals, or if they're in the evidence-based world, then plant-based doesn't intersect with that so much, right, in their minds.
Yeah, in their minds. And it is hard to get, you know, to do randomized controlled trials. I mean, it's hard to get them going in any discipline within science, but it's just, you know, there's so many books. Obviously, you read them, you read, you know, any Esselstyn book or Ornish book, or you read Dr. Greger's book, you know, and it's so compelling, and there is so much research and so much evidence, but I think it's just because it hasn't been widely adopted, people still have a difficult time swallowing it. But, you know, if you say, look, you try to suspend your disbelief a little bit and take our word for it and try it for a few weeks and see what happens to you. And the proof is really in the tofu-based pudding.
Right. Although that also could be said for paleo, for especially for a lot of people who move from standard American to paleo. You know, they try it for a few weeks and then they're convinced for life.
But how do their biometrics look?
Well, so yeah, some of them look pretty good. I mean, as much as it pains me to say it.
But, really? Their cholesterol and their blood pressure?
It goes down. I mean, it's better than, you know.
Right. They're eating fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
Or they're eating vegetables. Yeah.
So let's talk about you say plant-centered and minimally processed.
Yes.
So in terms of like guidelines, like a prescription, do people understand? So you have your, 5 to 7 fruits and vegetables, couple legumes, that sort of thing. But what are the dietary parameters that you tell people to follow?
Well, we have a chart that's got a spectrum on it, and it's color coded to show them kind of what you can eat a lot, what you should be eating a lot of, what you should be eating a little bit less of, and what you should be eating almost none of. And dairy, eggs, meat, all of that would be what we recommend you eat almost none of. I think we talked about this before, and you said you believe that it's better to be more specific about how many servings of one thing or another you have. But we didn't really do it that way. It was more like on this spectrum, try to eat as plant-based as possible and try to eat as many whole unprocessed foods as possible. So that's really what we recommended, and we gave a lot of plant-based recipes that used whole food nutrition, and then shopping lists, and all the shopping lists were completely plant-based and enabled, and there was nothing, minimally processed things like tofu or soy milk or almond milk, things like that are on there, but there's no veggie deli slices on there.
Right. Okay. So I want to move on to sort of the financial model, but I'm curious about self-care, because that's not something that I see in every program. I rarely see it. So you say 5 to 30 minutes of self-care. What does that look like?
Well, it's different things to different people. For some people, it's spending some time in nature, if they hopefully have access to some form of nature, and whether it's like a walk in the, by the beach, or it's a hike if they have time for that, or if it's just walking around the grounds outside their office building if there's a few trees around, just communing with nature a little bit. So that's for some people. Some people, it's just taking a bubble bath and just unplugging from the world. For some people, it's meditation or just purposeful breathing, mindfulness exercises. So for some people, it's doing some stretching or some yoga. So it's a range of things, but those are some examples of what a lot of people did.
And so I guess the underlying theme is take some time to put yourself first in a non-productive, quote, fashion, right? You're not trying to accomplish anything, but you're just taking time to put yourself and your well-being first ahead of all your responsibilities and obligations.
Exactly. Yes. And it's actually, I think, one of the hardest things to do for sure, for a lot of people.
Why do you think that? Why is that?
Well, we're always going and everyone's so plugged in and I think partly it's just that everybody has a smartphone. And so if you have a minute to yourself, you're not taking that minute to yourself. Typically many people are using it to catch up on email or, read an article or play a game or whatever it may be, or text somebody. So we don't unplug generally, I think, as much anymore. And then, of course, there's more traffic and people work long hours, and there's a lot of reasons why, I think. But it's just, I think the thing that just tends to fall by the wayside the most is people think, I can let that slide, because there's not as much of maybe a tangible and immediate benefit that people can see from, doing that, although the benefits are, are huge, but it's tough. When time is so limited, it's like, okay, well, I already took the time to make my salad and I brought it to to work, so I get a pat on the back for that, don't I? And I walk up the stairs 3 times, and so, like, I, something's got to give, and it's self-care.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's interesting when you say, you know, sort of not an immediate and tangible benefit, because, like, certain types of self-care, like, I enjoy them while I do them, you know, like the bubble bath or the walk in the woods. But others, like meditation, is like, oh, this is really hard. When is it over? You know, has it been 20 minutes yet? Oh, it's been 45 seconds.
Yeah, that's true, too. But we encourage people to download, like, the Headspace app or one of the other meditation apps, because they do, there are the nice little 10-minute snippets, and then you don't have to do it completely on your own. I'm a fan of that because, yeah, I struggle with meditation as well. So,
Yeah, Headspace is terrific.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the money, because the rap against this is that you can't make money telling people to eat fruits and veggies. That, you know, you can make money, you know, selling them pharmaceuticals and doing procedures.
Right.
And certainly at this point, there's a lot more money. So in terms of, you know, exposure and advertising, we're undergunned. But how did you go about deciding, like, this is, you know, this is not just my social service project, but this is going to be if not entirely lucrative, maybe lucrative is important, but at least, you know, sustainable, fine, happy way for people to make a living. How did you go about deciding if that was possible and then structuring something that would do that?
Well, a few things. One, I did want it to be lucrative because having worked in academia and, the nonprofit world a bit, I wanted to create something that people were willing to pay for, you know, something of value that people were willing to fork over money for. And of course, I'm not talking about individual people because I don't think individual people really are willing to fork over much money. But also to your question, yes, we're spending over $3 trillion annually on healthcare, and by many estimates, 86% of that goes to chronic disease management. So so there's a lot of money to be saved. And I say, well, let's capture some of that savings. Because there's a huge ROI. When we can successfully do this with people, and we're going after the high-risk folks who are the 20% of the people spending 80% of healthcare dollars in the commercially insured population. So, yes, we'd love to do it with a Medicaid population or, you know, other populations, but we want to really establish it first in the commercially insured because that's where it can be more feasibly paid for. Certainly CMS can pay for it also, but that's another hoop to jump through later. I think it right away, because there is such a huge potential savings. I mean, there was a RAND study that showed, I think it was $3 or $3.50 of ROI for disease management program in the workplace, whereas only it's like 50 cents for wellness program. So for disease management programs for people who already have diseases, there's like $3 or $3.50 of ROI per dollar spent. But we're not a disease management program. We don't want to manage disease. We want to put it out of business. So I think that there's real potential there for revenue. If we do it right. It's hard. I mean, for sure, health plans are big and slow moving, slow to change.
Right.
That's why we're really trying to do a few pilots and really, really continue to prove out the model before we secure commercial customers.
Uh-huh. And so that RAND study, the 50 cents ROI for wellness, which sounds like a negative ROI, right? Like you lose half of the money?
Right. You Exactly. Yeah.
So I've seen a lot of wellness programs, and I got to tell you that a lot of what I see these days, or like in the last 3 or 4 years at like health tech conferences and things like that, it kind of reminds me of when I was in New York City during the dot-com boom. Like there was, and I didn't know it then, but it's sort of like a lot of smoke and mirrors and like really beautiful apps. And like there wasn't much substance to it. And as I see, as I look at wellness programs across the board, like they seem very tepid, and their food plan is essentially like a Weight Watchers, eat a little bit less, have the chicken salad or the shrimp kebabs. Like when you look in the marketplace at wellness, technically savvy wellness program competitors, what do you see?
I do see, I've seen a few programs that seem a little bit more substantive, but yes, I think overall, if there's not a lot of, first of all, up until recently, there hasn't been a lot of data collection and data tracking. And like one of the reasons we take biometrics because it's so meaningful, the change is so meaningful, but it's also very meaningful in terms of it being a bellwether for ROI. So I think that there's been not much of that. There's more of that now because there's more of a demand for it, for actually, looking at the investment that these companies are making and seeing if it's worthwhile. But, a lot of it's very fluffy for sure. No question still. And then I think it just also depends on the approach. Like I've seen a program similar to WellStart that is, a keto diet, so it's like WellStart, except it's all meat. And to me, that's horrifying, but some people are doing that. So there's different approaches too. And I don't know if, maybe some employers will be convinced they're actually doing a B2C model, but so maybe some people will go to the health center, stop in, and then like stock up on their bacon and reverse their diabetes. I don't know how they're going to do long-term, how they'll fare long-term, but.
Yeah. It seems like there's three things you've got to get right in this marketplace. And, one of them is the technology and the messaging apps and the dashboards and all that. The second is the underlying behavioral economics. And, you and I talked a couple of weeks ago offline and like, you're a behavioral economic ninja, right? Around taking these best practices and principles and figuring out how to apply them here. Even when your technology was kind of, free and sucky and piecemeal, like Google Groups and FaceTime, and like before there was anything put together, it was being driven by behavioral principles as opposed to being driven by the CIO and their bells and whistles. But the third part is the science, and it sounds like you sort of have a triple threat there.
I like to think so. It's all an experiment at this point. There are a couple. There's a company called Life Dojo. Have you heard of them?
No.
So they're a wellness program, and they do something that I think is like 12 or 14 weeks. And their concept is they tailor it to the individual within for the employees. And I think that it is important to tailor advice and motivation to individuals as much as you can, but they don't have. There's nothing. It's not plant based. It's just, getting people to eat healthier. There's Ramada Health, who's delivering the diabetes prevention program digitally, and great, but the DASH diet, I think clinicians and those who are developing these programs are really afraid that if you ask people too much, they're not going to do it. If you ask people to give up too much, they're not going to do it. But I think you're doing people a disservice if you tell them, oh, you're pre-diabetic and eat the DASH diet.
Uh-huh. Because the DASH diet is seen as doable and socially acceptable, like the best will get them to do.
Yeah. Right. So let's just give them the best. That, I mean, I think that we saw the same thing with smoking many years ago. It was like, oh, yeah, well, what are we going to do? Tell them to stop smoking? Well, it was really hard because the doctors were smoking, too.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah. So, and the doctors are still, in our analogy, doing the smoking, too. I mean, you know, if we could teach the power of nutrition therapy to more physicians, I think that could be a powerful thing if they were able to see it firsthand. So I think there's certainly a lot of psychology to it too, but it's an ongoing evolution.
Right. So before I let you go, tell us about the pilot that you're running for those lucky folks in California who could participate.
So it's a 12-week pilot. There's no cost to the participant. You'll get your biometrics taken at the beginning and the end of the program. We'll just send folks to a lab for that, and they'll see a physician online through telemedicine 3 times. They'll see a dietitian 4 times. They will get daily text messages and a daily, really short, digestible article that will help teach them some of the principles behind the program and of basically intensive therapeutic lifestyle change, which is what we're doing. And they'll get a lot of resources to help them make it easier. They'll get an online group discussion. And we do actually a weekly reflective activity we just send people to do on their own, and they can share that experience with the physician or the dietitian if they so choose.
Gotcha.
So that's the program, and it's really great. There's, really no downside to doing it at all. I think if anyone who wants to get healthier and, you know, is at high risk, either has high blood pressure or high cholesterol or prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, and has a BMI over 25.
Oh, great. So the inclusion criteria is some sort of abnormal basic lab work or diabetes and a BMI of 25 or over? Or over 25?
Over 25, preferably, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And those folks, what should they do? Where should they go?
They can contact me. They can email me at olivia@wellstarthealth.com.
Okay. That's wellstarthealth, HEALTH.com.
Yep.
Okay. And just let you know they're interested. And when does the pilot begin? So what's their deadline?
As soon as possible, because as soon as we get a full bus, the bus is going to leave the station.
Okay. And for those people who are listening to this not live, which will be everyone, today is July 28th, 2016. So when you hear this and you want to join, or, you know, I suspect a lot of listeners to this podcast themselves have made those dietary changes already, and they may not be participants. They may not fit the criteria, but I bet they know people. So
Their aunt or cousin in California. Yeah. Send them my way.
Is there a web page where people can read more about this?
You know, we have our website is basically right now just a landing page, wellstarthealth.com. But I will be putting some of the recruitment slides for participants up on the site. So check it out, and hopefully it will be up there in the next little while. So yeah, that's another good source.
Okay, well, I'll send this out to thousands of people, so that should light a fire.
Okay.
That's what I need. Yeah, I need to get anything done anyway.
Yeah, I have been sending the recruitment materials to people, like to various people, employers and such. But yeah, I think putting it up on the website is a good idea.
Awesome. Yeah, if you're in California, or you know someone in California who could use a a new start to their health. They could use an intensive therapeutic lifestyle change, plant-based. And you're listening right now, go, run, don't walk, to your email and email olivia@wellstarthealth.com. And Olivia Kelly, what an amazing journey you're on. And, I can't wait to see you guys, listed in all the angel funding things and all the tech highlights, and having cracked the code on how to get people healthier in a way that that works in our society and our economy. So,
you and me both.
thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks, it's been so much fun. Thanks, sir, for having me.
All right, be well.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Plant Yourself podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes with links to everything we talked about at plantyourself.com/166. And by the way, if you want to get fit and healthy, even if you've tried before and failed, especially if you've tried before and failed, check out, for the very last time in a couple of months, the Big Change Program at bigchangeprogram.com. We had our first class this morning, and we got so excited we only got through half of the material on menu, on shopping and preparing food. So we added a bonus class for this Thursday. So if you want to join, you can still get your 3 live classes, as well as, of course, all the replays. This is absolutely your last day to register. We won't be opening it up again until the fall, and it will be priced higher, probably significantly so. If you're new to the Plant Yourself podcast, you can catch up on 165 archived episodes over at plantyourself.com. And if you get the podcast but not the weekly email newsletter, get over to plantyourself.com and sign up. I include links to original articles, I share recent episodes of my Tribe Well TV show, and I generally try to use proper grammar and avoid typos and misspellings. Thanks, big, big thanks to Plant Yourself Podcast patrons Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Disson, Brittany Porter, Dominic Morrow, Elizabeth Clifton, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Christine Nielsen, Tina Sharp, Tina Ahern, John Vilkanovsky, David Bizek, Michelle X, the Mysterious, Elspeth Feldman, Victoria Dolomanova, and Leah Stoller, for your generous support of the podcast. Do you guys notice I'm getting better at those names? You need to challenge me by having more people supporting the show that way, so I can add some new ones to that litany, to that wonderful list. If you'd like to become a patron, you can do so by clicking one of the donate buttons on plantyourself.com on the right sidebar. If you'd like to support the show in other equally important ways, you can share this and other episodes on social media and via email. And one of the most impactful things you can do in just a few seconds is to write a review on iTunes. I can't tell you how important that is for getting the show's ratings up, for getting it shown to more people. Every review seems to really give us a boost in how many people we can reach with this message. And so if you listen to the Plant Yourself podcast religiously or semi-religiously or semi-observantly, and you spend some time listening and getting value, maybe take a minute, write that review. That will help us, and it will help us reach a lot more people. And a bunch of very kind people have left 5-star reviews over the past month, and here are a couple of them. Emily94 says, "It's addicting and entertaining." She said, "I stumbled across this jewel, and all I can say is I love it. Learning at the same time as being entertained, I listen to this daily now on my drive home." So we're at episode 166, so that's almost half a year of daily drives. And if we skip weekends, I think we can make it through about 2/3 of the year. Eric SJC says, "Howard is a great interviewer, exclamation point. Howard does an awesome job asking questions and drawing out information from his guests. This is my favorite plant-based podcast." Oh, thanks, guys. Thanks, Emily and Eric. Next week on the show, I don't have a guest lined up. How exciting and how scary. Stay tuned. In garden news, it's not so exciting. It's all cukes all the time. My spell checker keeps insisting that I mean it's all cakes all the time, in a kind of mean, passive-aggressive way, and not a little bit judgmental, if you ask me. But it's Kirby's and Armenian cucumbers and various other kinds. So if you have any good recipes that call for a ton of cucumbers, do me a favor and post them in comments. Again, it's plantyourself.com/166. That's it for this week. So as always, Be well, my friends.